This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Northwest Indiana veterans and their family members and caregivers had a chance recently to talk with people who are in charge of the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago at a recent town hall meeting that was held at the Adam Benjamin Jr. Outpatient Clinic in Crown Point. And we have with us one of the important people that came to speak at the town hall meeting. Mark McGill is the medical director for the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago, and he's joining us today. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate being able to talk to you and your audience.
One of the things that you took time to explain in more detail to people at the town hall meeting, and I'm sure you got some questions you had to answer, is a program which is called REACH. Will you explain a little bit what REACH means and how it pertains to veterans here in Northwest Indiana?
Yes. REACH is a continuation of several programs that VA has to support family members and caregivers of veterans and actually provide services to them so they can better help their veteran that they're providing care for. Mm-hmm. So REACH actually stands for Resources for Enhancing All Caregivers' Health. And so the main objective is to improve the emotional and the physical well-being of caregivers. And I tell you what, directly then that will enhance the quality of care for their loved ones, for the veteran.
I know there's this ongoing concern about the sad fact that veterans happen to commit suicide every day across the region and across the nation. And I know that has the Veterans Administration very concerned about trying to find ways to deal with that. Does this particular program that you explained at the town hall meeting help in that way?
It helps indirectly because one of the things that the caregivers are taught problem-solving skills and stress-solving skills, stress management, and of course that's for themselves, but that also helps in the relationship with the veteran, and they know more about whatever disease or chronic or acute that their loved one has, mm-hmm. and so they can help in compliance. And that understanding just also has benefits with the veteran provider relationship as well. So it's good all the way around. Now, so you ask specifically about prevention of suicide. Right now, the program is centered around actually more medical diagnoses, things like dementia, multiple sclerosis, ALS. PTS is in there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why I said there is an indirect relationship. But as far as the prevention of suicide yeah. awareness, that's not specifically one of the things that or screens that are concentrated on.
But I suppose, though, that because these caregivers and others get this training and assistance to recognize some of these things, that some of the veterans that may have these diseases, like you say, ALS or multiple sclerosis or PTSD, they tend to be more, unfortunately, more susceptible to the possibility of a suicide.
Anyone that has a chronic disease, anyone that has you know chronic pain that they're dealing with, there's so many factors that enter into veteran suicide. But yes, anything that would help awareness of that, help that veteran talk about some of those issues, and the family member be involved in that conversation, it's going to have a benefit.
What was the program started out at least on a pilot basis, and when did the Veterans Administration decide to go ahead and implement it across the board, so to speak?
Actually, this is just recent. There have been some facilities across the country that have been doing this, maybe not by the same name. Actually, Jesse Brown has been providing similar services. We have caregiver support. We have a very aggressive telehealth program, and we involve the veteran's family in that. We have whole health. which I'd love to talk about if we have some time.
Certainly.
That we involve the family member in as well and bring them into the treatment and help make sure that they have the knowledge and the skills that will help in the treatment.
All right. Well, let's take a moment to talk about whole health here, and I'm sure it was probably one of the things that you talked about at the recent town hall meeting in Crown Point, and probably got some questions that needed to be answered as well.
Okay, great. Well, whole health, very simply, is when the veteran is meeting with their primary care physician. And that's the primary care, or the PCP as we call it, is the focal point of all the care that the veteran will receive. Now, if they need specialty or mental health or any other sort of care, that primary care physician is definitely in the loop with the team that provides that care. So, in that initial relationship with the primary care provider, it's very important for the veteran to be part of what the goal is. So, from a doc standpoint, you know, docs very much and very appropriately, they care about things. Am I overweight? Am I managing my diabetes appropriately? Do I smoke? And so, you know, it's very easy to, okay, veteran patient, you need to lose weight, you need to stop smoking, you need to do this or that. And again, all that is, from a physician standpoint, very correct. What we have found will resonate more with veteran is, what is their health goal? So, in other words, then, they are directly asked in the visit with primary care physician, what do you want from this visit? What is your health goal? And just as an example, one of my favorite stories is that had a veteran come in and had all kinds of actually multiple issues, COPD and overweight and smoked, and I think he had some cardiac issues. And so the whole thing was, he just wanted to be able to go fishing with his grandson. And he had been pretty much housebound, not able to do that. And so between his provider and, of course, with him and then with his family member, and this is where REACH or caregiver support comes in, mm-hmm. there was a plan that was developed. And, of course, those other things were addressed, but now the veteran had part of that plan and was responsible and more compliant. And so the good news is, and this is a true story, that veteran was able to take his grandson fishing.
That's wonderful news. That's good to hear. Mark, what other questions or concerns came up when you got together with the veterans and families and caregivers that showed up for the town hall meeting in Crown Point?
Well, I think one of the things that is on our veterans' mind, they've heard a lot about the Mission Act. And they might not have heard it specifically as far as the legislation or the name, the Mission Act, but they've heard a lot about, you know, hey, is VA care going to be privatized? Is what are the changes as far as VA care? Do I have choice anymore? Remember, Choice was the program that a couple of years ago was implemented.
Yeah.
Well, Choice has Choice is no longer with us, and so the Mission Act basically extends Choice. And if you remember the old 30-40 rule, Mission Act does away with that.
Right.
And in effect, veterans are able to go to, and this is simplifying it a little bit, but they're able to go to any provider that they want to go to, and VA will assist in the scheduling and the billing for that. So what that does is that increases choice and access for veterans, and it allows the VA then to have more part of making sure that the administrative part of that care is appropriately provided. Now, the Mission Act is not fully implemented yet, so how the specifics and how that will work, all that is to come yet. So I do want to mention that the VA across the country is having listening sessions to veterans, and on the VA website, there is information about the Mission Act, and so I'd really ask your listeners to go on and learn more about that. But what I do want to stress is it is not a privatization act. It actually gives the veteran more choice, and it helps us as the VA be able to work better with our community partners in making sure that that veteran's taken care of.
Well, Mark, it sounds like quite a few things that got brought up at the town hall meeting. You've had a chance to explain a number of things, like the REACH program and the updates here on the concerns that veterans have had here with the VA and the reorganization and the like. So it sounds like there'll be more opportunities to come back in for more town hall meetings in the future.
Absolutely. And I like to get out to all of our sites of care several times a year, and we have town halls, we have informal gatherings, sometimes we'll go out and talk with our veterans, our population. Of course, we have at the medical center every quarter, we have our large town halls, and we'll definitely continue those. One thing I'm kind of excited about, we might try this next time out at ABJ, is we're going to try to stream this out over social media in real time.
That'd be great. Because there are a number of veterans, I'm sure, and their family members that can't be there in Crown Point to be witness to the actual meeting, but they'd still like to watch what was happening, listen to what was happening, and maybe even participate in the discussion, too. So that sounds great. Well, Mark, thank you for the updates. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to being back with you again soon, and thank you for spending time with us today.
Okay, absolutely, Chris, and again, appreciate the opportunity to do that and talk about the services that we can provide to our veterans.
Mark McGill is the medical director for the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago.
The total out-of-pocket cost for Hoosiers with employer-based health insurance has doubled in the last decade, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us about a new analysis that focuses on policies that could help improve affordability.
More than half the people in Indiana receive health insurance through their employers, and the cost continues to rise. Hoosiers spend about 6% of their median income on insurance with an average $1,800 deductible. Sarah Collins with the Commonwealth Fund says middle-income people feel the pinch most.
So we're just finding that the rate of growth in what people are spending or contributing to their premiums is climbing faster than growth in median income.
Premium costs rose more than 13% in just 1 year between 2016 and 2017. The report says Congress could take action by providing more tax credits and covering more services. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
A farm bill compromise announced this week includes removing hemp from a list of banned substances and making it a regular agricultural crop. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us, changing the plant's classification might ease some Indiana lawmakers' concerns.
Previous attempts have been made to legalize hemp production in Indiana, but have failed in the Senate thanks to concerns about the plant's relationship to marijuana. Indiana Farm Bureau State Government Relations Director Justin Snyder predicts the language in the federal farm bill might be the change that finally gets such a bill to the governor's desk in 2019.
I think that's the thing that really is needed to put everyone at ease at the state level.
Indiana farmer Mike Boyer was able to grow hemp on his farm through a research permit this past season. He dismisses the argument farmers would stop growing other crops if they could grow hemp.
This is not going to be a commodity crop replacement. This is simply will be something that will add diversity and another crop to our rotation here within our own state.
A study committee this summer examined the issue in hopes of crafting legislation for the session, which begins next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Now it's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Ms. Allison Mihalich. She's a Senior Program Director for the Office of Sustainability from the University of Notre Dame. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Allison, I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with the University of Notre Dame, but tell us a bit about your role with the Office of Sustainability.
Certainly. So my role here in the office is primarily to advance the sustainability strategy document, which includes a sustainability standing committee and 7 small working groups. So my job is to facilitate 4 of those 7 sustainability working groups.
Mm-hmm.
My boss, Carol Mullaney, is responsible for the other 3. I'm also responsible for tackling metrics to hopefully move the needle forward. And my goal is that our office serves as the hub for sustainability efforts across campus.
Wonderful. So I know the university has some impressive emission reduction goals. So how did these come about, and what are your plans for reaching those?
So our utilities department has had a long-range utilities planning process in place since 2003. Our office has only been around for the past 10 years. So the utilities department has really been foundational in setting that first emissions reduction goal with a goal by 2030 to reduce our scope 1 and 2 emissions by 50%. And then 83% by 2050. And they do it through that long-range plan. Diversifying our energy portfolio is really one of the key ways we reduce emissions, as well as our set point policy here on campus, which sets temperatures in buildings. That is one of our largest contributors, one of the largest energy conservation measures we have on campus.
I see. So we recently heard about Notre Dame's food to waste to electricity program. So that sounds really interesting. Can you tell our listeners about that project?
This is a project I'm really excited about. This was what was given to me on day one, and I'm really, really looking forward to it coming online. We're working on a project that installs commercial-grade grinders in our food prep areas at three different locations, two of our dining halls and then our big catering center. The grinder itself can capture 100% of non-consumable food waste. It then creates a really nice food waste slurry that is stored in an enclosed heated tank and agitated. We're working with an area septic hauler to service the tank and deliver that slurry to a local anaerobic digester where it's going to be converted into methane and then captured and sold back to the grid.
Wonderful. That sounds exciting. So I know the university also has a food rescue and recovery effort in place. So tell us a little bit about that.
So the university is doing a lot in terms of tackling food waste. We have a partnership with Cultivate Culinary, a great organization in the area, to recover consumable food waste, such as leftovers from large catering events or athletic practices. And we deliver that food to Cultivate Culinary that processes and repackages the food in easy-to-heat-up meals. To me, it reminds me a lot of Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a student group on campus tackling food rescue through a partnership with Food Rescue USA. And that student group delivers food to area homeless shelters and addiction recovery centers.
Wow, that's very interesting. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Ms. Allison Mihalich. She's a senior program director for the Office of Sustainability at the University of Notre Dame. So, Allison, I know you wanted to talk a bit about the student community garden as well.
Absolutely. This is really one of the coolest perks of my job. The university reinstated its community garden, which is adjacent to campus, in 2010 for community members connected to Notre Dame to grow their own food.
Mm.
We also have a student garden that was reinstated in the 2017-2018 academic year, and it's a tremendous way for folks to get involved, grow their own fresh organic produce, and all of the compost used at the garden is sourced from our landscape clippings.
Wonderful. And I know your office is also involved in Notre Dame's comprehensive sustainability strategy, which embraces the university's Catholic tradition of Pope Francis' call for creation care. So what does that strategy involve?
Sure. So our comprehensive sustainability strategy was published in 2016, shortly after the Pope's encyclical Laudato Si, and it really is grounded in our Catholic mission and ties to Catholic social teachings. There are six main areas called out in the strategy. I've spoken to a couple of them: energy and emissions, that long-range goal. There's water-related goals as well as waste, building and construction goals, procurement, licensing, and food sourcing, and then education, research, and community outreach. After the strategy was released, we realized we really needed to add a seventh key strategy to advance communications to better shine a light on all of the sustainability-related efforts on campus.
As we come to the end of our show, Allison, can you maybe talk about some of the things that you think what Notre Dame will look like in maybe 5 years?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot that's going to happen in terms of waste and recycling. We've implemented a new recycling program, and I think that, as well as our building portfolio and some of our energy-related projects, are things that folks will be really pleased to hear that we have some big wins. And I would suggest folks visit our website and check our Facebook and Twitter to keep up to date.
Well, Allison, great work. Looking forward to having you on future shows and continue the great work with the University of Notre Dame. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to our guest, Ms. Allison Mihalich. Senior Program Director for the Office of Sustainability at the University of Notre Dame. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Greenfleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Greenfleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts of Greenfleet Radio are available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. Scott Miley is the Indiana State House reporter for an organization called CNHI, which is a nationwide organization of community newspapers, including three here in Indiana, Tribune Star in Terre Haute, the Herald Bulletin in Anderson, and the Kokomo Tribune. And Scott's been working on a series of articles, and continuing series, actually, dealing with township governments. And one of these articles has come out here recently, deals with the the average township government in Indiana holding a rather sizable balance in their budgets. And to go into more detail, we have Scott Miley with us from Indianapolis. Scott, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Sure, Chris.
Well, yeah. Kind of set things up here, if you will. Tell us a little bit about the series of articles that you are working on, and more articles are coming out in the newspapers within the group, and how they pertain to Indiana government and how government in townships in particular seem to be run.
We had talked. We have had an editor's meeting last year and talked about updating the system of township government in Indiana. Every township, all 1,005 townships, have a trustee, and almost all have advisory boards, which are composed of three members. It goes back to 2007. When then Governor Mitch Daniels formed a commission with Chief Justice Randy Shepard and former Governor Joe Kernan to look at government reform. And it's known as the Kernan-Shepard Report, and they came up with 27 recommendations. One of them was combining township services into county units of government. For example, one of the services trustees offers is poor relief to people who need emergency help for housing, utility, and food. So we started looking at those costs and found some, I guess, staggering numbers in particularly in the surpluses that the townships have.
Did you determine in looking at the record and some of these budgets that you had to, and we'll go into more detail about this, that not all townships in Indiana have surpluses this large or any surpluses really at all?
Yes. There are some. some didn't report their numbers to the state as they should have, but there are some down to 9%, 17%. As far as a surplus over their certified budget. We had talked to some experts. No one wants to actually state what the percentage is for a rainy day fund or how much you should have in excess.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, if you look at the state has $1.8 billion in reserve. And that's about 11%, 12% of the budget. So we kind of went off of that. We asked a number of officials what should be a good number, and they thought, you know, you got to have a 3-month balance for emergency situations. Other townships are saving up to buy a fire truck or to build a fire station. So there's a number of reasons that justify the holdings, but we talked to some who just had no idea what they were going to do with the money they have saved up.
Have they set up, I guess, some resolution or some legal means to be able to keep track of this extra money, create this rainy day fund in many cases?
They keep track of them just through the State Board of Accounts and the Department of Local Government Finance in their annual budgets. For example, I think overall, if you take in all township certified budgets, and they're certified by the state, there's $390 million last year, total budgets. But their balance, you know, the amount that they had saved up amounts to $453 million. So that's, if you add that together, that's 116% over their budget. Like we said, some are, you know, planning ahead and know what to do, but many can't tell you what they want to do. So a state representative from Batesville, her name is Cindy Zemke. She's a Republican, and she has tried to reform township government in the past with just minor success. This time she's going to go after the surpluses. And she would like, although the bill hasn't been published yet, they're going to be published yet this week, she will ask for townships to be required to submit a capital improvement plan that lists what they plan to do with surpluses. And that will have to be filed with the state. If it's not, then there'll be some mechanism that they won't get their money.
Does her recommended measure that comes up here before the General Assembly this session just continue on with this effort that has been followed, I guess, going all the way back to the Kernan Shepherd Commission during the Mitch Daniels era, that to try to either control or even abolish townships in Indiana?
I think she certainly would like to control them, because she's introduced bills in the past that would... in fact, this last session, back in early 2018, she introduced a bill that would force townships with populations under 1,200 residents to merge or consolidate with a neighboring township. She thought that would be a way to make government more efficient and might cost less to administer township services.
In your research, do you feel that that she is trying to not only to keep a closer handle financially on townships, certainly within her area, because she's in southeastern Indiana, but as a way to follow through on the Kernan Shepherd Commission recommendations to kind of rein in the number of townships in the state?
Yes, I think so. I think she was very influenced by the Kernan Shepherd report. I can't remember the first year that she ran, but the report had already been out, and she was very influenced by the attempts for local government reform. It had the report had minimal impact, although it did lead to the removal of the property assessment functions from townships.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, it was just a few years ago that they were combined into county assessor offices, and that provides a more uniform property tax assessment. So that was one good thing out of the report. And I think Zemke and others, she's not the only one, but she's the one who turns out to be the author on some of the bills. Representative Jerry Torr, Republican out of Carmel, has also been on these bills that want to tighten up government expenses.
We're talking with Scott Miley. He's the State House reporter for the CNHI, a group of community newspapers across the country, and particularly here in Indiana, three newspapers, Terre Haute and Anderson and Kokomo among them. Are you finding in the research that you're doing for your series of articles about townships in Indiana that there are some other efforts that are underway to keep track of what township spending is like, and in turn not only educate readers for the newspapers that you work for, but also citizens in Indiana that may in turn lead to smaller townships and better run governments?
Ran across one gentleman down in southeastern Indiana who has been trying to get three township trustees to talk about merging their services so that it might be able to attract new business and industry to the area. And he's been working on this for a number of months. I talked to him the first time he was publicizing the effort back in, I think, April. And so there are smaller attempts, but for the most part, a lot of the initial interest from the Kernan Shepherd report died down because it just got too much opposition from Indiana Farm Bureau is one of those that's been against consolidation. The Indiana Township Association, which represents about 600, 700 of the townships, was also against it up until this last session when they initially went along with Zemke's attempt to consolidate townships under 1,200 population. But within a few weeks, they also ended up opposing it because the Indiana Volunteer Firefighters Association got involved. So there's a number of very strong groups out there that are opposing the consolidation. I'm not so sure so many will oppose the Representative Zemke's capital improvement plan. I think many of them that I've talked to realize that it's one way to justify to taxpayers their budgets.
Do you also see, too, that there'll be some movement from the state government? We know that the Department of Local Government Finance is keeping an eye on this, I'm sure, very closely, and as is the State Board of Accounts. They already have some control, I guess, within their own statutes to be able to keep track of how county government keeps track of their money and grows as well.
They do. They're excellent at keeping track of the monies, but they don't have an enforcement arm. If a trustee takes off, let's say, and we're writing about some of these, a trustee taking off with writing herself checks for her own personal use, they don't have, the State Board of Accounts and Department of Local Government Finance don't have enforcement arms to go after them. Instead, the State Board of Accounts will turn over their report to a local prosecutor who can then decide what to do with it. And also the Indiana Attorney General's Office can file a civil suit seeking damages. So it gets kind of convoluted, but this way with Zemke's new bill, it might add a little bit of enforcement, at least control over when the townships get their budget. Or get their funding.
Yeah. And we know for sure here in Northwest Indiana in particular, there have been concerns. There have been, of course, long-standing concerns about public corruption issues. And it's come down now to the township level in some cases. Calumet Township and some other townships, certainly here in our region, are keeping a close eye on this because I'm sure that they feel that if this measure that Representative Zemke is proposing could very well clamp down on some of the issues that they keep bringing up or have being brought up in turn with these local audits, I'm sure.
Yes, and Calumet's a really interesting case in that they're pulling out, or that Griffith is pulling out of the township. I need to read further about that to see who's going to be covering the services that the township provided. But that's a really interesting case, and that's what a lot of the townships face, is that, well, if I merge with my neighbor, then who's going to pay for fire services? Or who gets the fire truck? Who gets the station? It comes down to that kind of political argument.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of interesting questions, certainly that the cases here in Northwest Indiana are bringing up, and there are probably a lot of townships across Indiana, including within the area that you cover, the newspapers that you work for, that are keeping a close eye on what Northwest Indiana townships are doing.
Yes, and it's one way we hope of, you know, educating Hoosiers, too, who really don't seem to know much about their township government. We took a survey, in fact, we did two surveys, and in one of them, of 560 Hoosiers, we found that 82% could not identify their township trustee, but 71% thought that the township duties should be moved to a county agency. So we weren't real sure what that meant. It seemed like some were aware of it, whereas 82% couldn't name their trustee.
Well, it sounds like more education is needed, and it's certainly going to come about. You, representing your newspapers, will do their part to be able to help your readers in your particular area be able to get that information and, in turn, educate them and maybe strengthen what efforts that Representative Zimke is trying to do on a statewide level, to be sure. Scott, thank you for spending some time and going over this, and we'll keep an eye out for more articles that you're continuing in your series that you're representing in the newspapers that you put out for Terre Haute, for Anderson, as well as for Kokomo. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.
Scott Miley is a State House reporter. He's the correspondent for the CNHI community newspapers, which include newspapers in Anderson, Kokomo, and in Terre Haute.
At a UN climate summit in Poland, the Trump administration is promoting fossil fuels, but local officials from around the U.S. are there pledging to reduce emissions.
Sort of says, hey, look, the water's warm. If Pittsburgh can do it, we all can do it.
Plus, the investigation into alleged ballot fraud in North Carolina. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in starting at 3 o'clock today for All Things Considered on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
All of us here at Lakeshore Public Radio want to thank Santa's Holiday Forest for their generous donation of gift cards for this past winter membership drive. None of us knows what stories we'll need to follow in 2019, but we'll be on the job every day thanks to your support. If you haven't had a chance to make a donation, there's still time. Head over to lakeshorepublicradio.org before December 31st and click on the white donate button to become a sustaining member today.
There's been something actually in the Indiana statutes for years about what constitutes bias, but there really hasn't been a lot that maybe are giving prosecutors a bit more of tools to be able to offer any greater sanction on any offenders that may be accused of bias. But there is a bill that has been filed that will come up in the upcoming General Assembly session from our next guest and a co-sponsor as well that will take the hate crime measure one step further. And we have with us Senator Mike Bohacek from Michiana Shores. And thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity.
You and your colleague, Senator Ron Elting from Lafayette, have proposed what is right now listed as Senate Bill 12, which will go into great detail on some additions that will be made to Indiana criminal law for prosecutors and for judges to take a look at when it comes time to deal with a particular case. If you will, first tell us what you feel are the most important additions that the measure that you and your colleague are offering up for lawmakers to consider this session.
Sure. Certainly, what we did is, and I know, unfortunately, this is always called hate crimes, and it's really not. This is true bias crimes legislation. And as you look at the legislation, it makes sure that everybody, regardless of whatever characteristics they have, are protected. But it happens at time of sentencing. So as opposed to creating a new group of laws, this gives our judges the opportunity, and I trust the subject matter experts, which is our elected judiciary, to, at time of sentencing, use a sentencing aggravator. So let me give you an example. So if you were convicted of battery, and that's a level 6 felony, there's an advisory prison sentence. The judges can go on the lesser side via mitigators or on the more aggressive side versus aggravators. This bias crimes legislation at time of sentencing provides our judiciary the ability, if they see fit, to be able to aggravate the sentence. What's nice about this, or, I mean, none of this is nice, but the flexible part of this is that even in the case of a plea agreement, so if a level 5 felony is pled down to a 6, the judges can still utilize this aggravator at time of sentencing. So we're hoping it's going to be a deterrent, but if not, it allows the judiciary to sentence as they see best fit.
A bit more flexibility than perhaps what the current statutes call for, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are there any points in particular, and I know that the additions that are put into the law, which is stated in the bill, talk about specific situations or incidents that perhaps, if you want to call them that, that might be considered more as bias indicators here. What are these points that maybe are not in the measure now that will perhaps make this measure more attractive when the lawmakers have to take a look at it when session starts?
Certainly, yeah. When I had co-authored a bill last year, the scope was very very narrow. There was, I think there was about 8 different categories of bias. But Senator Alton and myself realized that bias is bigger than that. And in listening to a debate during committee and other conversations, we realized that we needed to have maybe a little bit a bigger scope, but then also make sure that as times change, the legislation can also grow with our community, which the last qualifier also protects bias in any other identifiable group, and I think you'll see that in the bill. Mm-hmm. So as times change, this would allow the bill to be dynamic and not have to continue to be readdressed over and over again. And once again, gives our judiciary, who are our elected judges, to utilize this the statute as they see fit. So I think it's a real, probably the biggest part of this, or the biggest attribute of the bill, is the flexibility that we have now that previous legislation attempts did not have.
Does the measure that you and Senator Alding are proposing not necessarily focus more on, but have bring up maybe more prominently the issue of concerns about bias and discrimination against gays and lesbians and transgender and bisexual people?
Gender identity, mm-hmm. is in the bill, whether it's perceived or actual. Sexual identity is there, whether it's perceived or actual. We also, have many other specifically protected classes, and then also some broad language that would also address situations that potentially were missed. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very very broad reaching piece of legislation.
More so than what the current statute has, apparently, right?
Well, the current statute is a Supreme Court opinion. So some say that our judges can already do this. There's some debate about that as far as the ease of being able to utilize bias as an aggravator. And Senator Alton and myself believe that the best way to let our judiciary handle this is with specific statutorial language, and thus Senate Bill 12.
Were there any examples or incidents or other information that's come forth here in the meantime that you and Senator Alting have taken a look at to bring up the issue of I guess bias, certainly in this case here, some would call them hate crimes, that maybe is what prompted you, besides wanting to beef up and make this bill a bit more comprehensive than last time?
We get asked that question all the time. What specifically triggered you to author this legislation? Senator Alton and I, have the same conversation. We just feel that it's time. It's been time for many, many years. We can talk about the young man that was accosted in Chicago just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. We can talk about synagogue vandalism. We can talk about any number of issues. We can talk about the young man in North Central Indiana who was victimized due to bias. When you're authoring legislation, you hope that it's not due to single issues, but more importantly, it's an overreaching effort to resolve something that's just not addressed and it's not right. Mm-hmm.
I know there's also one other question that's come up here and has been asked before, and you probably had to answer before, too, about what kind of economic impact, if there is any, that if this bill passes and it becomes law as the session goes on, would benefit Indiana perhaps more so, since Indiana, and it's been published before and mentioned before about the fact that Indiana is only one of 5 states that does have a quote-unquote hate crimes bill.
Right. And we've talked about this too. Many of the chambers of commerce support this. Our public universities support this. Many in our business community support this. And you're absolutely right. Part of this is also an economic bill. As companies look to relocate to a state, they look for specific protections, and they look for legislative things that are going to benefit their business. Now, Indiana does an exceptional job of attracting new businesses. But on this social side, I think we've kind of missed a little bit. And I think it's probably cost us some higher-end tech opportunities because we just, we just don't have these protections. So, and you're absolutely right. We need to look at this a little bit more beyond the criminal side and also onto the economic development side to be able to attract, you know, great talent from other states and also great opportunities. So you're absolutely correct. It's a bigger issue than just the criminal side.
Now, let me ask the question. I know you're optimistic about this. You have to be optimistic about the bills that you either introduce on your own or you introduce with your colleagues in the Indiana Senate. Do you think that the way this measure has been written, and maybe you've gotten some indication from your colleagues also ahead of time, that this measure may have some chance of passage this time?
During the session, especially this early on, because the session doesn't start until January, I'm cautiously optimistic, but we're working to educate our colleagues and on both sides of the aisle, because there's resistance on the Democrat side too. Some folks think this doesn't go far enough, trying to get some consensus. Now, both myself and Senator Alteen, we're cautiously optimistic. We're working very hard to gain consensus and to address the issues that our colleagues may have on both sides of the aisle to see if we can get something that's workable, that will pass quickly. We've been working on this for 3 years. So, the saying at the State House is great legislation typically takes 3 sessions, bad legislation takes 1. And I think after 3+ years of vetting this, I think we have a good piece of legislation.
Well, Senator Bohachek, thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and see what your colleagues on the floor of the Senate and over in the House, because they'll have to take a look at it, too, if it gets out of the Senate before it goes on, if it's passed by both houses to go on to the governor for his review. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about this, and as always, we hope that this next session goes well for you and your colleagues at the State House.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking with Indiana State Senator Mike Bohachek. He's a Republican from Michiana Shores, and he and his colleague Senator Ron Alting from Lafayette are producing a measure which deals with the question of bias, making some changes that perhaps lawmakers and judges will best be able to use when they take up these cases when they come before them. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us now in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I have heard throughout the years that it is more blessed to give than to receive, especially around the holidays. Well, I wonder what does that mean for a dog or a cat? Last Christmas, I did a whole lot of getting. I got toys, biscuits, and my cat friend got weird toys with feathers and wands even. I received a red sweater, Christmas sweater, with an embroidered tree that lights up. It should be entered in the Ugly Christmas Trees contest. Or is that just for humans? When my owner put it on me and I lighted it up, I stopped moving and just stood there. I mean, I'd still be standing if it weren't for the obnoxious human kid who took the sweater off of me and wrapped me in a towel. Don't even ask. I was a real good sport, excepting for the sweater debacle. I didn't topple the Christmas tree. I didn't eat the tinsel. I never ate a wrap package or sucked down a kid's toy. I did, however, nosh on some turkey on my search under the table, but didn't knock over the Christmas candles with a sweep of my tail. Then there are the lush red and green plants, which include cactus, holly, lilies, mistletoe, poinsettia, hemlock, and ivy, which the florists deliver to our house nonstop during Christmas season. Sometimes I lift my leg on them with the sheer delight of seeing their red and green selves shine, and sometimes I just want to eat one. But I didn't rip them into tiny green shreds because I was on my best behavior ever. My pet parents have lots of friends who come and go over the holidays. I usually hunker down under the table and look for my opportunity to bolt. Last year I did run off, but I was immediately returned because I was wearing my collar and tags. And my identification tag says proudly, Brad Pitbull. Happy holidays, Ollie. You are my man.
Dear Brad Pitbull, I wish you a happy holiday, too. You are bragging that you were very good last Christmas, and obviously that is your gift to your pet parents. Really? Well, they are luckier than mine. to my woman and man human, Christmas giving to me and the rest of the pet brood here is simply trying to be on our best behavior. We realize that no human wants to run to a veterinarian during the holidays because their pet has eaten or ingested something they shouldn't. Second to that Christmas horror is finding a pet missing and phoning the local shelters to find it when they are closed for the holidays. So, I try to be a good dog, but in many ways, it's not possible. I tore into a white paper bag carrying fruitcake from a local bakery. I have vomited on the carpet right before the guests pulled up in their cars. I scratch doors, growl at other dogs, and not come when I am called. In years past, I have swirled around the house, stealing toys, and behaved worse than Thing 1 and Thing 2 that appear in The Cat in the Hat. My humans nicknamed me the Christmas Thing 3. It seems to be a tradition here. But so far this year, I've been good. Okay, the holidays have not quite started yet. But I am certain, Brad Pitbull, that your good behavior through the Christmas holiday season was a welcome gift to everyone in your household last year. Congratulations. Will you be on your best behavior this year, too? Remember not to chase the cat in your house or eat anything with sugar, turkey skin or bones, mistletoe, holly, or poinsettias. Tell your cat friend to stay away from raw fish, onions and chives, uncooked eggs, and caffeinated drinks. For a complete list of holiday food spoilers for household pets, go to the ASPCA, that's the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals website. And while you're at it, the gift's in the mail. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. And remember, love is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. And the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana, by the way, is hosting an Adopt-a-thon at Pet Supplies Plus in Crown Point on December 15th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow is Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we will have with us to talk about the stories that they've posted online or in print, Meredith Kolias-Pete with the Post Tribune and Bill Dolan with the Times, and we'll also find out more from Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. We hope you'll join us.